KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The White House is gearing up to ask Congress to eliminate nearly all funding for public broadcasting.
NPR CEO Catherine Marr joins us to talk about what lies ahead.
Today is Wednesday, April 16th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Ahead this hour, two new studies suggest that stem cells are finally close to helping people with Parkinson's disease.
Now we have tools that can intervene, and so we have the potential to really, really halt this disease in its tracks.
Also, rural school districts across America are mourning the loss of federal funds.
We need more teachers in the policy conversation. Because right now we have billionaires dictating what's happening to working class families.
And ever had an awkward moment in public? I sure have. NPR's Life Kit has ideas on how to get over it.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. A federal judge in Washington now says he has found probable cause to hold the Trump administration in criminal contempt. The ruling today in connection with the violation of his orders last month that planes carrying Venezuelan deportees to a prison in El Salvador turn around. NPR's Adrian Florido says U.S. District Judge James Boasberg is warning of potential prosecutions, though whether today's order changes it is unclear.
Well, members of the Trump administration have said they're not going to let courts get in their way of carrying out the president's priorities. And today is the first time a judge has clearly said they will be punished for not obeying courts. If they still refuse, that is where legal experts say that we will have a full-blown constitutional crisis where the balance of powers between the executive and judicial branches may not hold.
Trump administration, meanwhile, said today it will appeal. Police in Pennsylvania say the man who allegedly set fire to the state governor's home may have been politically motivated. From member station WITF, Rachel McDevitt reports a search warrant shows the man was angry about Israel's war in Gaza.
Call records show Cody Ballmer called 911 about an hour after he threw Molotov cocktails into Governor Josh Shapiro's residence early Sunday morning. Ballmer reportedly told the dispatcher that Shapiro needs to know that Ballmer, quote, will not take part in his plans for what he wants to do to the Palestinian people, unquote. Shapiro, who is Jewish, said Wednesday he'll leave the question of motive to investigators, but
nothing he could do would deter me from proudly and openly practicing my faith.
Shapiro has been critical of some pro-Palestinian demonstrations in Pennsylvania. He has said he supports a two-state solution. For NPR News, I'm Rachel McDevitt in Harrisburg.
Elon Musk's Doge cost-cutting team says it's come up with hundreds of millions of dollars worth of what it's calling fraudulent unemployment claims. However, the fraud the group says it's come up with does not appear to be anything new. Labor Department's own inspector general found major problems during the pandemic with filing abuses. When Federal Reserve Board Chair Jerome Powell speaks, the financial markets listen, and investors appear to have not liked what they heard today. Speaking to members of the Economic Club of Chicago, the Fed chairman had this response when asked whether the central bank might be ready to take action as a result of current market turmoil over President Trump's tariffs.
As that great Chicagoan, Ferris Bueller, once noted, life moves pretty fast. For the time being, we are well positioned to wait for greater clarity before considering any adjustments to our policy stance.
Powell did warn of a challenging scenario posed by the tariffs, though, and did note there could be difficult trade-offs ahead as tariffs push up consumer prices while weakening economic activity. Stocks, meanwhile, took a major tumble following the Fed chair's remarks. The Dow fell nearly 700 points today. You're listening to NPR. Students in Department of Defense-run schools are suing the administration for allegedly removing books and changing curricula based on President Donald Trump's executive order to remove gender ideology and divisive concepts. Kentucky Public Radio's Sylvia Goodman has more.
Jessica Henninger has three children in a school run by the Department of Defense Education Activity in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. She says books and curriculum have been removed and a project celebrating Black History Month canceled.
My husband fights for our constitutional rights and our freedoms in this country, and to see those rights being taken away from my children was just absolutely something that I could not abide.
The curriculum list marked do not use includes a fourth grade reading called A Nation of Immigrants. Other DOD-led academies have also cut books, including nearly 400 from the U.S. Naval Academy. A spokesperson for DODEA told NPR he cannot comment on active litigation, but the military schools are committed to providing an excellent educational experience. For NPR News, I'm Sylvia Goodman in Louisville, Kentucky.
California Governor Gavin Newsom says he intends to challenge the Trump administration's tariffs. Newsom saying today the administration lacks the authority to put in place a sweeping 10% tariff on all imports coming into the U.S. and says he's filed a lawsuit seeking to block the tariffs, which he says will drive up prices and cost California billions. California is a major point of entry for imported goods coming into the U.S. Newsom argues agricultural exports are also being affected. White House continues to defend the tariffs. Mounting global tensions also boosted oil prices today, oil up $1.14 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. NPR has long had a policy that when we find ourselves in the headlines, we cover ourselves as we would any other organization. Well, NPR is in the headlines this week. That is because the Trump administration has drafted a memo to Congress calling for lawmakers to end nearly all federal funding to public media. That includes NPR and PBS and would include money already appropriated by Congress. That's according to a White House official who spoke to NPR. So we have invited our president and CEO, Catherine Meyer, to speak with us live. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I want to quickly clarify the relationship here for people listening. You are my boss. You hold the top job at NPR. But you're not a journalist. You're not involved in newsroom editorial decisions.
That's completely correct.
And you, your office, you have not seen or had input into the questions that I am about to ask you.
That's right.
I want to note, we have asked, the newsroom has asked the White House to comment on what their goal is here with pulling back funding. They have not responded. They have posted on the White House website a list of NPR and PBS stories that it says represent biased content and, quote, radical woke propaganda disguised as news. This includes stories dealing with LGBTQ issues, with coverage of race, coverage of politics. Understanding, Catherine, that many of the examples on this list date from before your tenure, does NPR stand by its journalism?
Absolutely.
Has NPR been formally notified by the White House about the rescission?
We have not.
How much money is at stake?
In this particular package, it would be all the funds for fiscal year 26 and 27. For public radio in total, that is about $250 million. For public media as a whole, it's a little over $1 billion, including public television.
Okay. The central question, what would be the effect on NPR of losing government funding?
The biggest effect would be on the NPR network, which are the 246 stations around the country that you're probably listening to us on right now. Those are our member stations, and they receive about 100 million of the 122 million that goes to public radio every single year. So the big impact would be on rural stations, stations in geographies that are quite large or complex in order to be able to receive broadcast where infrastructure costs are very high. You could see some of those stations really having to cut back services or potentially going away altogether.
So we're throwing around a lot of big numbers here, but basically just to stick with this point, because I think a lot of people may not understand, NPR, the network you and I work for, gets around 1% of our annual budget directly from the federal government. You're making the point that a lot of our member stations would be hit considerably harder.
That's correct. So we receive about 1% of our budget. It goes to support things like body armor for journalists covering conflict overseas, extra support for our presidential national elections, all the sorts of things that we want to invest in to ensure that we're able to report on issues that matter to the public. But generally speaking, most of our operating budget comes from our membership fees, and that's what allow our members to be able to receive programming. It comes from underwriting support. It comes from private donations, individual audience member donations. And that same thing is true for member stations, except federal funding makes up a much bigger percentage of their total budget.
If all government funding goes away, would we survive?
I think the question is, would we be able to thrive as a national network? That is what I am focused on, is we get so much value as public media by being part of a 50-state network that covers 99.7% of the American population. If federal funding goes away, that network is absolutely at risk. The quality of service, the ability to cover everyone, people who live in what would otherwise be news deserts, and as a result, there's no question that NPR would not be able to pull from that richness of our national coverage if those
local
newsrooms.
Right, so it's local newsrooms that would be going away, and often in places where local newspapers have already been decimated.
That's exactly right.
Altogether. Make the case, why should any tax dollars support public broadcasting when there are plenty of other news organizations around, when anyone, frankly, these days can produce programming on their iPhone?
Well, absolutely. And I think that it's important for public media to be able to continue to be relevant in a time where there is a lot of coverage of different issues and areas of interest. And at the same time, I think it's very easy to say that there's universal coverage because there's so much content being produced. But the reality is there are many places in this country that do not have that kind of access to either cell phone service or high-speed broadband, where radio may be the only way to reach communities with regular access to news. Public media also supports local news coverage in places we've already mentioned, that about 20% of Americans live in an area without any other local news coverage other than their local public radio station. This is tremendously important as a public service. And just because not every single person uses it every day, you know, I don't drive on our interstates every day. And yet when I need it, it's there. The same is true of public media.
Just to put the question to you quite bluntly, to quote the words of Marjorie Taylor Greene, the Georgia congresswoman who was running the subcommittee here, where I know you were just summoned to testify last month, she said, look, you can hate us on your own dime. To which you say what?
We don't hate anyone at public media. We report on the news, and we encourage that we are reaching out to people from all different backgrounds, political persuasions, belief sets, and we want to be able to hear the voices of the American public reflected on public media in the same way.
Just to put one more challenge question to you, because this is a question I get and I want to let you respond to it. Does public funding hold NPR back? And to explain that question, I mean, we are editorially independent. We're speaking, you and I, right now in the newsroom. I know that. But if one of the goals is to avoid even the appearance of government influence, why not walk away from this money?
I actually think public funding ensures that we hold tight to a mission that reigns reflecting all Americans. Most commercial outlets are able to target certain audiences that they want to reach. We have an actual obligation in our mission and in our funding model to try to serve everyone across the country. Now, we won't always be able to serve everyone, every belief set, every need, every interest, but we need to serve as broad an audience as possible. That's the point of public broadcasting, is to be able to put the public in conversation with one another and to operate off a shared set of conversations about what's going on in the world.
Catherine Marr, our boss, NPR CEO and president, thank you for coming to the studio and taking our questions today.
Thank you for having me.
It makes sense that tariffs on imported cars will lead to higher prices. But did you know that tariffs also push up prices of car parts from around the world? And that, in turn, will drive up car insurance. NPR's Camila Domonoske explains why.
Tariffs on auto parts specifically are looming, but tariffs on steel, aluminum, and imports in general are driving up prices already. Laurent Spence works at a Napa auto parts shop in Desert Hot Springs, California.
Brake pads normally come from Mexico. We have suspension parts that come in from Turkey, from Thailand. a lot of our tool sections come from Taiwan. And then I'm also in charge of price changes, you know, for the labels.
So you're literally changing the prices on the shelf.
Every day.
Pre-tariffs, he'd swap out some prices at least once a week, often for sales. Now it's daily and mostly going up. Spence owns two older cars and he's been buying up parts for himself.
Absolutely, yeah. So belts, ball joints, control arms. I'm just kind of stockpiling on nearly everything that I will need in the future as a just in case.
When parts get more expensive, that pushes up the costs of repairs and maintenance. And when the cost of repairs goes up, that's a big expense for insurance companies. Jessica Caldwell is the head of insights at the auto data company Edmunds.
Anytime that you're in a collision and your vehicle needs to be repaired, there requires parts, perhaps some aluminum or steel if you damage the outside portion of your vehicle, and all that's going to lead to is higher insurance costs.
Higher insurance costs, because if insurance companies have to pay more for repairs, they're going to charge more in premiums. That's fundamentally how insurance works, right? It spreads a cost out among a big pool of people, even if you personally don't get in a crash. And this is true even if you have the bare minimum insurance. Shannon Martin is an insurance expert at Bankrate.
If you're someone who has an older car that's liability only, you might think, well, my rate's going to stay the same. But it won't, because you have a property damage coverage on your policy that pays for someone else's vehicle. That is now going to cost more to fix.
Something similar happened during the pandemic. Supply chain disruptions meant fewer vehicles and car parts available, and prices soared. A year or two later, insurance premiums soared too, up 20% in a single year. As of this year, those rate hikes had finally settled down.
But the tariff situation really kind of throws a monkey wrench into everything.
Now, there's a baked-in delay before insurance costs would rise. State regulators will try to protect ratepayers from unreasonable hikes, and current rates are locked in until your policy renews. But Martin warns eventually higher costs get passed along. President Trump says the goal of these tariffs is partly to encourage manufacturers to move to the U.S., although he also keeps changing the rules with exemptions and reprieves and deal-making. That makes it hard for companies to plan, and hard for drivers to know what to expect from, say, their insurance rates.
So any numbers that people give you are just guesses. That can change at any moment because everything's so unpredictable right now.
In these unpredictable times, some age-old advice is still reliable. Spence recommends having a trusted mechanic. Caldwell reminds folks to shop around. And Martin says, as always, drive carefully, y'all. A good driving record is one of the best things you can control to keep your rates down. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet during Earth Month and every month through the bold power of local and global action. Nature.org/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Two new studies suggest that Parkinson's disease can potentially be treated with stem cells placed in a patient's brain. NPR's John Hamilton reports that the studies show that scientists are close to their goal of replacing damaged brain cells with healthy ones.
Both studies are preliminary and small, but also encouraging. Dr. Lawrence Studer of Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York was part of a team that gave 12 people either a low or high dose of stem cells. He says over the next 18 months, the team used a standard rating scale to assess symptoms like tremor.
You would expect every year to get 2 to 3 points worse. And actually, the high dose group, they got about 20 points better.
The low dose group had a less dramatic benefit. A separate team in Kyoto, Japan, gave 7 patients a different type of stem cell. Their symptoms also improved. In both studies published in the journal Nature, transplanted stem cells began making the chemical messenger dopamine. It is the loss of dopamine-producing neurons that causes the tremor, slow movement, rigid posture, and balance problems that make Parkinson's so disabling. Studer says the success comes after decades of painstaking research.
For us, it's quite an exciting time, as you can imagine, being in the making for about 3 decades nearly. And finally seeing some of the fruits of that work.
Studer says one reason it's taken so long is that stem cells have the potential to become many different kinds of cells. He says it takes just the right mix of chemicals to produce a neuron that makes dopamine.
It took us nearly 10 years to figure out the recipe, how to make specifically those dopamine cells. Because not the 10 years to have the product that we would dare to put actually into patients.
The product is millions of what the team calls progenitor neurons. Dr. Vivian Tabar, a surgeon and stem cell scientist at Memorial Sloan Kettering, says these progenitor cells arrive frozen.
So you just thaw them and suspend them in an approved medium.
Until the patient is in the operating room. Then Tabar says the cells are injected into a structure found on both sides of the brain that is involved in movement.
The idea is to place these neuron progenitors right where you need them to connect with other neurons in the brain.
Tabar says that takes time. Also, she says, the cells are still maturing when they are injected.
This is not an intervention where a patient expects immediate reward.
But after weeks or months, Tabar says, PET scans showed that the transplanted cells were doing their job. Tabar says the results could signal the start of a new way of treating Parkinson's and perhaps other diseases.
If we're missing neurons, we're able to replace them, and the full expectation is that these cells are not going to function as cells that just release dopamine. They're going to rebuild circuitry.
There may be risks, though. Some earlier efforts to replace brain cells led to movement disorders and, in some patients, cancer. So Dr. Maya Sheese of UT Health in Houston says it's important to monitor the transplanted dopamine neurons.
They're going to be there for a long, long time, and you will have to follow up to see if over time there is like tumor formation, something of that nature.
Sheese also says stem cell transplants don't cure the underlying disease. Even so, she thinks they could offer new hope to many patients, including those who are no longer responding to drug treatment.
Now we have tools that can intervene, and so we have the potential to really, really halt this disease in its tracks.
The Food and Drug Administration has cleared the drug's maker, Blue Rock Therapeutics, to conduct a larger trial that could lead to approval. It's scheduled to begin later this year. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com.
Schools have a dilemma. Many are losing federal dollars for programs they consider essential as the Department of Education faces an uncertain future. Nebraska Public Media's Cassidy Arena reports on one program designed to help staff rural schools that is now endangered.
The U.S. has a hard time filling teaching positions. 86% of schools across the country report hiring challenges, says the National Center for Education Statistics. And studies show rural districts have the hardest time holding on to teachers. Nebraska is no exception. Most of its districts are considered rural, and finding teachers to fill those spots can be difficult. Nebraska thought it found a solution last summer with a program called Project Raices.
I've always said that Project Raices really gave me my voice.
Esra Alami is originally from Iraq and was raised in Lincoln. The first-generation college student never thought college was for her because of its expense, but she was one of 16 students to receive a full-ride scholarship to the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
Project Raices has honestly helped me discover, like, what is the difference I can make and should make, and how should I do that?
Raices stands for Re-envisioning Action and Innovation Through Community Collaborations for Equity Across Systems. It's a University of Nebraska-Lincoln program in partnership with Kansas State University, funded by a grant that came at the end of the Biden administration that was supposed to last 3 to 5 years. The universities had to prove the program enhanced equity, and that's where the problem now lies. Project Raices is among many programs that lost federal grant money due to the Trump administration's rollbacks on initiatives that promote diversity, equity, and inclusion. The Department of Education cut more than $600 million from teacher training programs. Superintendent Matt Farrup of Wakefield Community School District in northeastern Nebraska says while he understands why some people are concerned about diversity programs excluding certain groups, he says Project Raices was open to anyone who wanted to be a teacher.
This program is not discriminatory. It's not exclusive.
The Wakefield District has fewer than 600 students and has just short of 50 teachers.
It's trying to help us solve a problem that in 3 years will be an unbelievable crisis for every school district.
The crisis, says Dominique House, is that there are not enough teachers in the public education pipeline. She's with the Center for Black Educator Development.
We need more teachers in the policy conversation, because right now we have billionaires dictating what's happening to working class families and for children of working class families. That's not okay.
Ted Haman was a Project Raices co-leader. He says he was angry when he had to tell students the program funding was ending years earlier than planned, and all money would have to be returned.
I literally have 16 faces I can put in my mind of these are the folks whose prospective teaching futures are in jeopardy.
One of those students is University of Nebraska-Lincoln freshman Ali Wally. He studies secondary education with plans to teach in Lincoln Public Schools starting in 2028. He remembers the day he and the other students found out their program had ended early.
It was almost like a funeral, just the feelings and just the dread and the crying, and we were mourning.
And Wally says the cuts hurt putting teachers in school districts where they know the community.
This is the place I grew up. That's just one of the reasons why I think I would be so good at this job.
Less than a month after the announcement to cut Project Raices, education groups that work to expand the pool of qualified teachers filed a federal lawsuit against the Department of Education for cutting more than 100 teacher preparation programs across the country. A court ruling allows some of those programs to temporarily remain in place, but their future is still uncertain. And so is the fate of the Department of Education, which is undergoing a dismantling under the Trump administration. When repeated calls were made for comment about Project Raices, there was only a voicemail response that said the Department of Education's Information Resource Office is temporarily closed. For NPR News, I'm Cassidy Arena in Lincoln, Nebraska.
This is NPR News.
President Trump doesn't want to stop at sending migrants to prison in El Salvador. He says he wants to send U.S. citizens too. Critics say that's wrong.
There are profound ethical questions that this would signal about how we treat human beings who are U.S. citizens.
That story on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Author Katie Kitamura wanted to make her new novel a puzzle, but not one to solve.
I was speaking to a friend of mine who has a college-age son, and she said, but that's just a description of parenthood. That's what it's like every single time my son comes home.
That's ahead. First news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. A federal judge has ordered the Trump administration to provide more information about what it's done to bring back a migrant deported by mistake to El Salvador. That case has gone to the U.S. Supreme Court, where justices ordered the administration to facilitate the return of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, who was living in Maryland. But Attorney General Pam Bondi says he's not coming back, doubling down on the assertion that he's a gang member.
He was deported. They needed one additional step in paperwork, but now MS-13 is characterized, as they should be, as an FTO, as a foreign terrorist organization. So he is not coming back to our country.
The White House claimed to have evidence that Abrego Garcia is a dangerous gang member. Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt also presented criminal complaints accusing him of domestic abuse and what she described as evidence tying him to the notorious MS-13 gang. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. declared today that autism is epidemic in the U.S. He vowed to quickly identify the cause, as we hear from NPR's Rob Stein.
Kennedy is citing new statistics from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention as evidence that autism is epidemic in the U.S. The number of children diagnosed with autism increased from 1 out of 36 to 1 out of 31 kids between 2020 and 2022, according to the new CDC report. Kennedy says he's launching a new research project to identify an environmental toxin that he thinks is to blame. Independent experts say the autism numbers are up because of better diagnoses, and the cause is likely a complex combination of factors, including genetic predisposition. Rob Stein, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR. The Trump administration is proposing to limit what it means to harm an endangered species. NPR's Jonathan Lambert reports the move could make it easier to damage habitats that endangered species rely on.
The Endangered Species Act prohibits the take of endangered species. By law, take means to harass, harm, pursue, hunt, shoot, wound, kill, trap, capture, or collect a species. For decades, federal agencies have interpreted this definition to include harming the habitats endangered species depend on, since habitat loss is the biggest driver of species loss. Now, the Trump administration wants to narrow that interpretation. Their proposal would only prohibit harmful actions directed immediately against a particular animal, not their habitat. The change could make it easier for developers to build on habitats used by endangered species. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
The Trump administration is planning to end the free electronic system for filing tax returns directly to the IRS. That program was developed during the Biden administration, and many users said it made filing their taxes faster and easier. Republican lawmakers argued the program was a waste of taxpayer money because free filing programs already exist. Those programs are far more difficult to use. Stocks fell across the board on Wall Street today. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru. In partnership with the Arbor Day Foundation, Subaru is distributing over 100,000 trees this year to grow greener, healthier communities for generations to come. Subaru, more than a car company. And from Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. All 27 scientists at the Division of Viral Hepatitis have been laid off by the federal government. They received emails saying that their positions were duplicative, but NPR spoke with experts who say the work that this lab did to keep the public safe was unique, not just at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, but in the world. Kiara Eisner of NPR's investigations team spoke with five CDC employees who worked closely with the lab, and she joins us now. Hi, Kiara.
Hi.
Okay, first, can you just give us an idea of how big of a problem is hepatitis in the U.S. currently?
Yeah, hepatitis affects a lot of people. In 2022, there were more than 85,000 viral hepatitis infections in all 50 states and D.C. We know that more than 14,500 people died from a hepatitis infection that year because that's what was listed on their death certificates. But thousands more likely died from complications related to their infections, like liver disease.
Right. Okay, so explain how hepatitis is spread.
Anyone can get it. Some of the hepatitis viruses can be spread with person-to-person contact and contaminated food or drink. Others can be spread with sexual contact or needles and syringes, which is how health workers believe patients in Florida were contaminated in a hepatitis C outbreak that's ongoing in that state.
Wait, can you tell us more about that outbreak? Because, like, what is happening now when there are no scientists working in the CDC's hepatitis lab?
Yes, it's dire. I spoke to a CDC employee who told me that losing all the scientists in the lab has been devastating for epidemiologists who are still investigating the outbreak. They've looked for another lab to do the analysis the CDC's lab was doing in-house, but they said they haven't found a good alternative. Florida has already sent samples that they think could be linked to the outbreak, but the CDC wasn't able to test them before the layoffs. And I spoke to Kelly Rubleski. She's the director of infectious disease programs at the Association of Public Health Laboratories. She said shutting down this lab risks American lives.
More people get sick. Or you don't recognize outbreaks at all, and they just continue to spread unchecked. That's the ultimate risk.
That is the ultimate risk. Well, is the CDC looking into any other outbreaks right now?
Yes, there are current outbreak investigations in seven additional states, places like Massachusetts, Oregon, Wisconsin. Scientists say losing their jobs has stalled these investigations too. And the lab didn't just do hepatitis work. They're also prepared to respond to any kind of emergency. When everyone still knew very little about COVID in April of 2020, it was scientists in this hepatitis lab that switched to analyzing COVID samples. Some of the data they collected allowed Americans to understand the prevalence of COVID for the first time. CDC scientists said these people risked their lives to understand how contagious COVID was, and they'd do it again, but now they're stuck at home.
Well, while these 27 scientists are stuck at home, I mean, what's going on at their lab and with their equipment at the CDC?
Yeah, this lab has one of the largest hepatitis specimen collections in the world. They have nearly a million frozen vials in freezers at the CDC, and scientists don't know what's going to happen to those samples now. Then there's this computer software the lab built with a $6 million allocation from Congress. This is the only place in the world with that kind of genetic analysis software. That's what helps the scientists link outbreaks to their very source.
Mm-hmm.
But the program needs in-person maintenance to function, and scientists have been told they only have until the end of next week to access the lab. And two CDC employees told me some of them were initially turned away when they tried to enter the lab on Monday.
All right. That is NPR's Kiara Eisner. Thank you so much, Kiara.
Thank you.
People across the country are struggling to find housing they can afford. Half of renters in the U.S. spend roughly a third or more of their income on housing. Now, some institutions are stepping up to help. Churches across the country are building low-cost housing on their property. Audrey McGlinchey with member station KUT has one story in Austin, Texas.
Good morning, I'm Zion.
It's a Sunday morning in early March. More than 100 people have gathered at Mount Zion Baptist Church on Austin's east side. Pastor Daryl Horton steps to the pulpit. He has some announcements. The church is expanding its campus, but the building process is full of municipal red tape.
Y'all keep praying for the city as those permits keep going through. We keep sending the permit and they keep sending it back with little things that they want us to do.
Horton says building is part of the church's mission.
Yeah. We're going to get it straight and we're going to get it taken care of so we can continue to build what God has called us to build.
Mount Zion owns land a couple blocks over from the church. Recently, religious leaders decided to work with a developer to build about 80 apartments, homes they plan to rent to seniors at low costs. Horton estimates that half his congregation commutes in for Sunday service from nearby suburbs, where many have moved in search of cheaper housing. Away from the pulpit and in his office, the pastor quotes Jesus.
He says that when I was homeless, you gave me a place to stay. And so I think that that's part of just the dynamic and the heartbeat of what it means to be a person of faith, is to look out for those who are less fortunate and figure out how to help them to make ends meet.
Churches have long helped people struggling to afford housing, but building housing, this is something relatively new. The trend has a name, YGBY, Yes in God's Backyard. It's a play on YIMBY, Yes in My Backyard, which is a response to NIMBY, Not in My Backyard. In California, where housing costs are some of the highest in the country, lawmakers passed a bill in 2023 to make it easier to build homes on church land. Lawmakers in Texas are considering two similar bills. Another Sunday morning, this time at St. Austin's Catholic Parish. It's been around for more than a century, and that means its buildings near the University of Texas campus are old.
The bricks were falling off the face of our church. There was a design, onto the sidewalk.
Christopher Kennedy has been going to St. Austin's for 30 years. Nearly a decade ago, church leaders started asking, how were they going to pay for all the repairs the church needed, especially with fewer people at Mass filling collection baskets? What if the church leased some of its land to a developer? The church got nearly a dozen proposals, ranging from a movie theater
to a mini grocery store, drugstore, a whole bunch of different concepts.
Church leaders eventually picked housing. They finalized a 99-year deal with a developer. The church got a lump sum up front, $5 million. Kennedy estimates the rest of the payments will cover a good chunk of church expenses into the next century, regardless of how packed pews are on a Sunday.
Because of virtual church post-COVID, the consistency of every week Sunday, those don't occur anymore. Those days are gone.
A 29-story apartment building opened last fall. About a fifth of the units are rented at low costs, mostly to university students. This includes Miranda Farias. She's a senior at the University of Texas.
Like one of the nicest apartments I've lived in since I've been like at school here.
Farias says she pays $1,200 a month to split a two-bedroom apartment. That may not seem cheap, but in this part of Austin, it's a few hundred dollars a month less than apartments nearby. Farias didn't know she was living on land owned by a church, though she'd noticed the church building was so close that, from her vantage point, her apartment building seemed to be sitting on top of it.
I thought it was, like, cool that it was on top of a church. Like, I know that it was, like, connected.
Farias says she was raised Catholic.
I don't go to church anymore, but I feel like it's, if I did want to, like, it's literally right downstairs.
Some church leaders said this was an added bonus of building affordable housing. Residents living in apartments on church land might one day end up in the pews. For NPR News, I'm Audra McGlinchey in Austin.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Awkwardness. That is something we never quite outgrow, right? But LifeKit reporter Andy Tagle says there's also a lot of power to be found in embracing your awkwardness.
If you're often visited by the ghosts of humiliation's past, maybe when you're just trying to sleep or when a familiar song comes on, it might help to know that there's an actual term people use for these mental intruders: cringe attacks. These flashbacks might feel random, but
a time that you were really, really afraid or really angry, anything that's like emotionally heightened is going to stick in our brains.
Melissa Dahl is a writer and the author of Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness. The thing about embarrassment, she says, it's not universal. It's relative, uniquely formed by our culture, our social context, and our sense of self to help guide us back to the safety of our clans. So you might look at these memories as alarm bells. Remember, stick with the group. Don't stray too far from the cave.
And if you were cast out, you would be like, you know, eaten by a saber-toothed tiger or something like that. And it's always treated as if that doesn't apply to today.
But we all know there can still be real consequences when we don't follow social norms.
Isolation and loneliness is incredibly damaging. We still depend on social connection for our health and well-being and just general happiness.
So embarrassment is a pro-social tendency that can be positive in a lot of ways. For example, one study out of UC Berkeley from 2011 suggested that people who were more easily embarrassed were seen as more trustworthy and more generous than their less easily embarrassed counterparts. But of course, that doesn't help how much embarrassment can sting in the moment. So what can you do about it? One thing to remember is that your self-conscious feelings aren't always accurate. Take this famous study out of Cornell that Dahl told me about on something called the spotlight effect.
And it's basically like, we assume more people are paying attention to our faults and our embarrassing missteps than they are.
So in this study, researchers put a bunch of participants in a room and then had one person show up 5 minutes later.
And they made them wear a really silly t-shirt.
Really silly. It featured a large picture of Barry Manilow.
Afterwards, they asked them, okay, how many people do you think will remember that you're wearing this ridiculous t-shirt?
T-shirt wearing participants guessed that number would be about half. In reality, less than a quarter remembered who was on the shirt.
Which kind of cracks me up because the advice typically goes like, oh, like no one's paying attention to you anyway. And like, that's not actually what the study found. Like some people are, just not as many people as we think.
So relax. Even if you showed up to that meeting with a rip in your pants, chances are most of the people in the room didn't notice or didn't mind. If you're frequented by the same intense, embarrassing memories, there are some other things you can try to soften the edges a bit. One study showed that if you can shift your focus to other details surrounding a cringe attack, like what furniture was in the room at the time, you might be able to lessen the strength of the emotion tied to that memory. But you could also just, you know, try giving yourself a break, or maybe even a pat on the back.
Thank God I'm cringing over my past self, because that suggests some personal growth, hopefully.
Dahl says the more you can lighten up and laugh it off, the better. Because embarrassment can be isolating, but it doesn't have to be.
These feelings are just so wrapped up in empathy and connectedness. Even if it's horrible in the moment, you just have to remember that, like, it's going to make a really good story eventually.
For NPR's Life Kit, I'm Andy Tagel.
And for more tips, check out Life Kit at npr.org/lifekit.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The new novel, Audition, opens with a scene in a Manhattan restaurant. The narrator is meeting a young man for lunch, and everybody has a different understanding of their relationship. The woman, the man, the waiter. They might be parent and child. He could be her admirer. She might be paying him for a date. This sort of ambiguity is at the heart of Katie Kittimore's novel. She told me she got the idea for the book from a headline she saw years ago.
The headline said, "A stranger told me he was my son." And I actually never read the article because I almost immediately knew that I wanted to write a novel on this premise. I was completely captivated by the idea that in a single encounter, in a single moment, everything you understand about yourself and your place in the world could be overturned. But I was also fascinated by the kind of opposition between stranger and son. Those are two words that we think of as diametrically opposed, kind of mutually exclusive. And I was interested in that tension. And for a long time, I couldn't really figure it out. I kept thinking, what is it about this that interests me? And finally, I was speaking to a friend of mine who has an older child, a kind of college-age son. And she said, "But that's just a description of parenthood. That's what it's like every single time my son comes home." And so that was when I kind of cracked the idea open. You know, I had this sense I wanted to write about how at the heart of some very, very universal experiences of parenthood, of marriage, of love, of making art, are these kind of inherent contradictions that can't really be resolved.
Others have explored the idea that you don't really know the people closest to you, but this book explores it in a really, the word that I keep seeing that I think is very accurate is a very destabilizing way. It's hard to find your footing in this book.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to find a kind of mode of storytelling, a form for the novel that would convey that destabilization you're talking about when you feel that somebody you should know very, very well, whether it's your partner or your mother or your child, suddenly does appear to you as a stranger. And I thought there has to be a form of storytelling that will convey some of that. So the book is, I think, quite disorienting. It's a little bit like a hall of mirrors in a way.
Let's talk about the form, because it's very startling. Halfway through the narrative, there is a hard break, and when the story picks up again, the relationships have changed in a way that is unnerving, disorienting, choose your word. Did you always know this would be a narrative split in two?
I mean, I'm fascinated by stories that are cut in half. I don't know. I think about something like Vertigo, the Hitchcock movie, is kind of sliced right in half. There are other examples. There's a wonderful Japanese film by the director Kore-eda Hirokazu called Shoplifters, which in the middle of the movie, there's a kind of revelation and suddenly you understand everything about the characters differently. And I think I thought with this book, I wonder if I can enact that kind of change through form. And so what I did instead is I just took a leap of faith and I made a big running jump and hopefully landed on the other side.
There's also another layer to this story split in two, because your narrator is an actress who is rehearsing a play that is also divided into two disjointed parts, two parts that the narrator struggles to reconcile. Tell me about the kind of nesting dolls aspect of this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really interested in the idea that in all of us are irreconcilable, incommensurate parts of ourselves that can't be turned into a single unified identity. That's very much the struggle that the character is facing in the play that she's rehearsing. At some point, she says, there's not a kind of unifying identity for this character. The arc of this character isn't there. And that's the puzzle of the play, but in a lot of ways, it's also the puzzle of the book, which is, it's two parts, but they're not meant to fit together. They're meant to just sit alongside each other.
As I read it, as I finished reading it, I wondered whether I was supposed to be able to solve this puzzle. And from what you're saying, it sounds like no, a solution is not the point.
No, I mean, that's a kind of way of storytelling I love as a reader, but it's not something I'm interested in, I think, as a writer.
You don't want the Agatha Christie mystery that at the end we find out whodunit.
Well, I did grow up on mysteries. You know, it's funny you mentioned Agatha Christie, because I read those books compulsively as a child. I read them over and over and over again. And the thing is that it didn't matter if I knew the solution or not. I loved the form of it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's in my DNA as a writer in some way, the form of the mystery. But again, it's not a puzzle to be solved. I think I didn't like the idea of having an answer or knowing something that the reader didn't know. I didn't want it to be like the reader had to figure out something that I was withholding from them. It's very much a kind of book that's open to interpretation. It's been designed so that it can be read in two or three or maybe even four different ways. And I sometimes describe it a little bit as a kind of rabbit duck book.
The image that you can see as a rabbit or a duck.
Yes.
And so are readers, now that it's out in the world, coming up to you and saying specifically, I believed your book was about this, I read your book in that way, and they're irreconcilable?
Yes.
I think what you're describing is universal, this idea, it's not my idea, I forget where it came from, that the writer and the reader climb opposite sides of the mountain and meet at the top. But it feels much more true of this book than most that I've read.
That's so lovely, because that's really what I was hoping to do with this book. I really thought of it as an invitation to the reader. I felt when I was writing the book, I thought, I'm trying to just make a structure that is big enough to hold both me and the reader so that I can kind of invite the reader inside and say, make this book alongside me.
You said that different readers have approached you with different feelings or reactions or interpretations. And I would love to tell you mine.
Oh, I would love to hear it.
Which was, to me, the book gave me the experience of, at any minute, it could become a horror novel, but it never does. And it feels like a bizarre question to ask you, but I wonder if you can explain why I felt that way. Because I don't know why.
I mean, I was thinking about horror a lot when I was writing this book. And the book that I had in mind was Rosemary's Baby by Ira Levin, which is a novel about, I think, postpartum depression on one level. It's a novel about a family. It's a novel about real estate in New York. And in a lot of ways, Audition is all of those things. It feels a little bit like a haunted house story, I think. It's set more or less in one place, and all the characters are trapped in that space, and things start to unfurl a little bit. I also think the real moment of horror in any of these films or books is when you look at something you think you know and it looks unrecognizable. So there's a wonderful moment in Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House when the character looks out the window and she can see a part of the house she shouldn't be able to see. And it's something about the space itself has changed. The location that she knew very well is suddenly unrecognizable. And that, I hope, happens again and again in this book, whether it's the physical space of the apartment, the man the central character is married to, the younger man who enters her life.
Thank you for explaining why I felt that way. It's very, very helpful. I appreciate it. Katie Kitamura, it's been so great talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Her new novel is called Audition.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Total Wine & More for discovering something new, like a Cabernet or a single barrel bourbon. Learn more at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older. From Proven Winners with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens for gardens and landscapes at garden centers nationwide. Proven Winners Color Choice.